Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, February the 19th, Wisconsin's primary election day. Some reports from listeners earlier this morning that they waited in lines to vote already. So anecdotally, the cold temperatures don't seem to be hindering turnout yet anyway. So you've heard all the debates and the speeches and the commentators and the analysts and the straw polls. You've made up your mind, so just go vote. We will have updates on the results of today's voting tonight on the Ideas Network during newscasts. And tomorrow morning, all morning long, we'll talk with various analysts and other guests, and we'll give you an opportunity to react to how Wisconsin voted today, tomorrow. We're going to talk about the common sense values of Midwesterners during this hour, but we are going to try to avoid making this an hour of active or blatant campaigning for any of the presidential candidates who are running today. We are going to be talking with Dennis Boyles. He is the author of the new book, Superior Nebraska, The Common Sense Values of America's Heartland. You might recall the book that asked, "What's the matter with Kansas?" That book argued that rural Republicans frequently vote against their own interests in the name of social conservatism, that somehow wily conservatives would dupe these rural Midwesterners to vote for someone for the wrong reasons. Well, today, a rebuttal. A guest who says there's nothing wrong with the voters in Kansas or Nebraska or the rural Midwest in general. Dennis Boyles is the author of several books, including African Lives, A Man's Life, and the recently published Superior Nebraska, The Common Sense Values of America's Heartland. And he joins us by telephone from, of all places, France. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Joy?
You moved to France from the Midwest.
Yeah, my family still hasn't forgiven me.
Now, are you? There is a place called Superior Nebraska. Tell us about Superior Nebraska.
Well, it's a little town, about 2,000 people. It's on the big arc that is described by the Republican River as it flows across out of Colorado, across a corner of Kansas, through southern Nebraska, and then back down into Kansas again. And it's also the town, it's right on the Kansas border. It's the town where my father, my grandfather, my relatives, where we all spent very important days of our youth.
Yeah, and so you grew up there or spent some time there?
Well, I lived in Kansas until I was quite young. Until I was about 5 or 6. My family moved to California then, mm-hmm. and then they would send me back. Either they would drive me, or you know, we'd all go together as a family. Or as I got older, by the time I was 11 and 12, I was taking the Super Chief on the train. So every summer would be spent in Kansas, usually helping with the harvest. Mm-hmm. In that part of Kansas, it's a big business to sort of, you know, pile in trucks, go down to Texas, and then follow the wheat as it ripens up to the Canadian border.
Yeah. Now, Superior, Nebraska, it looks like, according to the map on the cover of the book, sits right on or near the Republican River.
It's right on the Republican, uh-huh. The Republican flows just south of town and right on the Kansas border, and it's a very important river. It's not a big river. It doesn't rage. It's not, you know, not boats going up and down or anything like that. But it irrigates a lot of farms, and there are persistent, complex water wars going on all the time between Colorado and Nebraska, or between Nebraska and Kansas. That water is very important, and without it, all of those farmers know they would be left high and dry, literally.
Yeah. Well, so is Superior, Nebraska, and the region generally do they vote red? Is that what is typically? It's a red state. Is that region a red region?
It depends on how you're looking at that. I mean, in terms of national elections, Yeah, typically they vote. I mean, in fact, every county through which the Republican River flows voted Republican in 2004. In 2006, the results were a little bit more varied. But when you come down to the state and local levels, there are some very liberal politicians representing some very conservative rural areas. And there doesn't seem to be a kind of a cookie-cutter mentality there in terms of voting for things that people really care about locally.
Yeah. So what are the common sense values of Superior, Nebraska?
Well, they're based on kind of agrarian values. You know, there's not a lot of room for theorizing if you're a farmer, for example. You have to do what you know works. And innovation is generally something that comes after, you know, long study and careful consideration. There's also an abiding sense of neighborliness. People might get mad at each other. In these little towns, there's always civil wars going on between the pessimists and the optimists and stuff like that. But they also know that they depend on each other intimately, not only to help if somebody gets sick next door, but because, you know, your shop depends on 5, 10, 15, and, you know, additional customers in order to make its profit. The main streets of these towns are very fragile economic environments. And so there's a lot of consideration for other people, too. And there's also a level of civility that is largely unknown, I think, on the coast. My wife says it starts in the middle of Ohio, where suddenly at drive-through windows, people are thanking you for ordering burgers and fries instead of just throwing them in your window. So I think these kinds of values are kind of characteristic of the Midwest generally. I don't think that they're owned by the Midwest, but I just think they tend to be much more in evidence there than elsewhere.
Well, are we talking? Is there a difference between? Oh, I don't know, Superior, Nebraska, this rural town of 2,000, and Superior, Wisconsin, which is a more of an incorporated city and an urban area in a blue region of Wisconsin.
Right. I think there is. I think that, you know, once these, you know, conurbations become large enough, government itself becomes a far more theoretical concept. In the book, I talk about, there's a photograph. It's called City Council Fixes the Sidewalk. It was taken in Cuba, Kansas, by a National Geographic photographer named Jim Richardson. Great photograph. The City Council Fixes the Sidewalk shows a picture of the mayor holding a wheelbarrow with two guys holding beer bottles on either side of them. They're pouring concrete into a hole in the ground. That is government in small towns. It's something that everybody has to shoulder. It's something that everybody has to do. It's a burden of daily life. It's not theoretical at all. It's you during your lunch hour. And I think that the larger a community becomes and the more these kinds of civic responsibilities are delegated to people that we hire to do them or something else, the more government itself becomes something kind of conceptual. You know, and I used to live in New York City, and I tell a story in the book about living at 28th and Lexington, and there was a pothole on Lexington Avenue all the years I lived there. If that pothole had been in Burr Oak, Kansas, or in small town Wisconsin, I would have gone out there with some gravel and fixed the stupid thing. But if I tried to do that in the middle of New York City, I'd be arrested. So there really is a difference in the way size affects people's sense of what government does and how it does it.
And so why does a small town, the small towns in the Midwest vote for Republican candidates?
Well, they don't. I mean, I don't know where that myth is sort of a convenient one, I think, for maybe Easterners or something. But the governor of Kansas for the last 50 years has been a Democrat for 33 of those years. There's never been a conservative who's won a statewide election in Kansas except Sam Brownback, the senator, and briefly an attorney general named Phil Klein. The majority voting in Kansas and in other parts of the Midwest tends to be moderate. And the fact that they didn't vote for John Kerry, but instead for George Bush, doesn't mean that they were, you know, flame-throwing conservatives or anything. They just thought that Bush made more sense than Kerry, and apparently that was kind of majority view. So, I think that the notion that that the entire Midwest is, is deep red is wrong. I think that it's reasonable, and whoever comes up with the best idea is the one who's going to win, regardless of what party they belong to.
Our guest is Dennis Boyles. He is the author of Superior Nebraska, The Common Sense Values of America's Heartland. You just heard him say that the rural Midwest, small-town Midwest, is not necessarily red. It's reasonable. What do you say? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned this afternoon. It's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, the Wisconsin state budget is at risk of deficit as the economy cools. During At Issue, after 5, Ben and his guest will discuss the issues facing the Wisconsin state budget. That's coming up later today. Right now, we're talking with a guest who says there's nothing wrong with Kansas. There's nothing the matter with Kansas. That book you might remember argued that rural Republicans frequently vote against their own interests in the name of social conservatism, that somehow rural Midwesterners are duped into voting against their own interests. Dennis Boyle says that's not the case. He writes about it in his recently published book, Superior Nebraska, The Common Sense Values of America's Heartland. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dennis Boyles, what prompted you to write this book? Was it the book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
No, not at all. In fact, I kind of like that book. I disagree with its conclusions for obvious reasons, but I think it's very well written, and I enjoyed reading it. No, what compelled me to write the book was getting calls. I was living on a farm in Pennsylvania at the end of the 2004 election, the day that that Bush surprisingly beat Kerry and rather handily. And my agent and a bunch of friends of mine in publishing were on the phone with me talking about the election. And mostly they wanted to know why people in the Midwest were so stupid. Why were they voting for Republicans? They couldn't figure this out. And, I'd lived there for years. I spent every summer of my childhood in Kansas and many winters, and I didn't understand how people could look at Midwesterners and think they're stupid simply because they didn't vote in a prescribed manner. So I decided to write the book, and to do it, I moved my family to a little town in Kansas. I tried to move to Superior, Nebraska, which had been pronounced dead by the New York Times, but there were no available houses. Everything was filled up. So I ended up downstream on the Republican River a little bit. I wanted to stay on that river because it's a pretty irresistible cartographic trope, I have to say. And we stayed there for 2.5 years while I worked on this book. They were 2.5 wonderful years. We left a little farm in France to go there. We'd spent our time divided between Pennsylvania and France. And when my children arrived, they thought, oh, no, a little dusty town in Kansas. But by the time they left, they had learned how to fence. They were taking chess lessons from a grandmaster Anatoly Karpov's chess school. They were involved in local drama groups. My middle daughter was in a little symphony orchestra that one of the communities had. They were involved with schools, and they loved it. And it was a great experience for us as a family. And one of the things it showed was, I think, the veracity of my view in this book, which is that there's nothing wrong with Kansas. There's nothing wrong with the Midwest. The only thing wrong is the stereotypical view people who don't know that area have of the residents there. You know, calling the Midwest Jesus land or something like that, it's just not a great way to win an argument. And it kind of puts the people who live in areas like that off a bit.
Yeah.
So I think those reasons all combine to sort of compel a new look at the Midwest and try to understand that it's politically the most complex place I've ever seen, this side of Italy anyway, and socially the most sophisticated place I've been in a long time. I mean, you go into a little tiny town like Alma, Nebraska. There's a little coffee bar there called Joe's Camera, and you can sit around in there and talk about what's going on in Paris, London, and Rome with people who've been there and who know the restaurants and know the sites. But you try to go to New York City and talk to somebody about Alma, Nebraska, and see how far you get.
Mm-hmm. So it's more that the people who live on the coasts or the big cities on the coast, at least, just view the Midwest as that flyover country and hapless, dumb voters.
Yeah, I mean, people who just don't kind of matter somehow. That my publisher is a great example. I mean, nice people, I like them all, but calling this book Superior Nebraska, when most of the book is about what goes on in Kansas, made no sense to me. And when I complained about it quite a bit, I was finally told, just forget about it, because really there's no difference between Kansas and Nebraska. Well, that may be true unless you go to the Church of Football, because you stand 5 feet on the other side of the Nebraska line and tell people how great the Jayhawks are, and you're in big trouble.
I didn't know that you had a fight with your publisher over that. You didn't want to call it that, but they thought that was just catchy.
Well,
Superior.
Really. I mean, it was the way I proposed the book. But you know, a year into the project, I said, no, this is going to be about the whole Republican River, and it is, and it was always supposed to be.
Yeah.
But they kind of fell in love with that title. And trying to explain to people in Kansas why they should buy a book named after a town in Nebraska is a hard sell.
Greg in Waukesha is with us. Hi, Greg.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'd just like to add that I spent the entire decade of the 90s in Clay Center, Nebraska, a town of 825. And I'm a living witness to the thesis of the guest this morning. Clay Center was a very fine town, occupied and inhabited by very hardworking and well-educated people. And what I would add is that no one in these small towns is anyone's patsy as far as politics go. People were very independent. And there might have been a tendency to vote one way or the other or to support parties. However, when it came right down to voting for the state, I think if you look at the governors of Nebraska, Ben Nelson, a Democrat, and prior to Ben Nelson, Bob Kerry. So I would say that these are hidden gems, and that people in these towns, myself included, are maybe a bit appreciative that people on either coast have the attitude that they do, because chances are they probably won't come and live there, which is, for a lot of people, is probably just as good. However, the experience was very good, and in our town we had people from not only all over the country, we had people from all over the world that chose to live there. Thank you very much.
Your reaction, Dennis Boyles?
I think it's great, Greg. I agree with it. I think that there's a tendency to look at voting, the voting registration in a state like Kansas or Nebraska, where it's overwhelmingly Republican. But when you look at the results of those elections, you realize that, really, it's exactly as he said. These people aren't dupes. If you've got a bad idea, you're not going to win office simply because you're a Republican. The reason these states are Republican is largely historical. Before the Civil War, bleeding Kansas was, at war with Democrats who wanted to spread slavery. So it became imperative to be a Republican. And most people sort of join the party their parents belong to and so on and so forth. But inside that Republican Party in Kansas, for example, there's the entire range of political opinion. There are extremely liberal Republicans and extremely conservative ones, and everything in between. And they all are nominally Republican, and they will gladly vote for a Democrat if the Democrat has an idea that makes sense to them.
There is an excerpt from the book that has been reprinted in a number of reviews and such that I've read about your book, and it says this: "There's a reason why even smart people voted for George Bush, a man whose rhetorical style is best suited to a pickup truck window, instead of John Kerry, a man who was clear and erudite in most of what he had to say. They simply liked what Bush said badly more than what Kerry said well." Really?
Yeah, really. I mean, it was, if you ask Democrats today whether they think John Kerry was a great candidate, most of them will say no, that's why he's not running. The campaign in the Midwest came down to ideas, and, they weren't put off as much as Easterners were by Bush's rhetorical style, which I personally find pretty appalling, but they listened, and they heard the ideas, they weighed them, and they voted. And the same people who voted for a Democratic governor or a Democratic representative voted for a Republican for president. And it had nothing to do with, being duped, being tripped by anybody.
Yeah. Well, how do you explain, Dennis Boyles, then, the various maps that show even in the Midwest, for example, I'm a bit familiar with Wisconsin more so than Kansas or Nebraska, that we do have these blue enclaves in Madison, Milwaukee, and Superior, which is in the northwestern corner of the state. They're usually the cities, the urban areas. Are they voted for Kerry, and the rural areas, just beyond the city limits of Madison, for that matter, voted for Bush.
Right. I think it's what we were talking about earlier in the program. I think that there's a distinct way in which people see government and see what government should do. And I think it's based on their experiences. And I think if you live in Madison, for example, and you work at the university, your view of government is going to be considerably different from somebody who lives 100 miles outside Madison, lives in a small town, and has to take his or her turn, fixing the streets or getting the water tower to work. I mean, that's what government does. And when national candidates appeal to people on the basis of what government should be and what these policies should do for people, people who have one view of government just won't agree with people who have a more theoretical view of it. So I think that's why this urban-rural kind of breakdown occurs.
Yeah. It's not because those urban dwellers have more education or money.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know. They may have more money, and maybe they have more education, although I was interested to see that the SAT scores of students in Kansas and Nebraska exceeded those of students in New Jersey and New York.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're smarter. Maybe they make more money or something. I really don't know. But I think that people listen carefully in the Midwest. They listen to what people have to say. They tend not to sort of vote in a knee-jerk fashion. I know lots and lots of Democrats who have told me that no matter who the Republicans ran, they would never vote Republican. But in the Midwest, you can meet an awful lot of Republicans who will gladly vote for a Democrat if the Democrat has an idea that they think will work.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me go to some more calls. Rocky in Hillsboro, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I'll try not to be long-winded. I agree 100% with the program. I live in rather a scenic part of Wisconsin, and I got a feeling that some of it is just fear, that people move to the cities or stay in the cities because, like an example, one guy that moved out here and then back, he said it was just too dark out here. And another lady, and her place was maybe a half mile to a quarter mile away from her nearest neighbor. She was afraid all the time when her husband would go to work. She was just afraid, so they had to move back to the city. And I think self-reliance, independence, and I don't know about the Republican Party actually today, but I think in the past at least, if you were a Republican, you always felt that you were more independent, self-reliant, and not fearful. You know, you hear the book title, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. Well, it doesn't. You damn well better know how to raise your own kids. And it's more of being an individual. And it's kind of like a herd of deer. When they're all together, they don't have to run faster away from the wolves than all the other deer. They only have to run faster than just one. And I think there's, to a certain extent, I think when you're in a city, some people simply feel that, I don't know what I'm trying to say, if the quality of humanity is less in the city than it is out in the country or what. I'm not sure about intelligence and all that. But I do know that the SAT scores in Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin are also ahead of a lot of the coastal states. But that's my point, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Boyles?
Well, Rocky, I mean, I think you make a good point. I think people's expectations for what government should be doing for them vary widely according to where they live. And it stands to reason that if you live in the middle of Racine or San Francisco or someplace like that, you expect the government to pretty much take care of everything that you can't take care of yourself. But it's not that way if you live in a small town. The little town of Greensburg, Kansas, is the one that was wiped off the map by a tornado. And I was writing about this and called Dennis McKinney, who's the minority leader in the Kansas House. He's a Democrat. He represents a small town of 1,500 in western Kansas that is, to me anyway, the epitome of self-reliance. And in talking to him, you realize, and he admits it himself, that he wouldn't have a place in the National Democratic Party because of his views. He in Kansas, he's enormously popular because he reflects the expectations people have for government in places like Greensburg. I called him just hours after that tornado hit, and you know he was talking about how people were already in there, you know, cleaning stuff up. You know, pickup trucks were coming in from towns all over, you know, and it was Monday morning before Governor Sebelius, who's kind of an Eastern Democrat governor of Kansas, I was on the television saying that Greensburg couldn't be helped because all the National Guard stuff was in Iraq. She backed off of that statement, but it was that kind of grandstanding that kind of puts people off a little bit. They thought they were doing a great job, you know, and the governor showed up and said that they were in terrible trouble, and in fact, they weren't. They bailed themselves out. That's the nature of small towns. It's how they survived, and I think that, you know, those kinds of things sort of speak to what Rocky's talking about, that people have an expectation for government in these small places that's radically different from the expectations people have in larger cities.
Thanks, Rocky. Randy in Madison is with us now. Hi, Randy.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think, and good morning to your guest, too. I disagree with him, though. I own rental properties in Madison and several small towns around Madison. And in my experience with the people in the smaller towns has been quite a bit different. There does tend to be less education. There does tend to be more of a blue-collar bent to it. And they tend to be very oriented to single-issue items, such as gun control and abortion. Those two things are real high on the list. And you know, to heck with the facts. Don't bother me with the facts, because I've got my mind made up on this one issue. And I think that's how we got stuck with George Bush a second time around.
Mm-hmm. Do they tend to be more single issue voters, Dennis Boyles, the rural Midwesterners?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there are some. There are always some on both sides. But these people lead complex, sometimes difficult lives. And I have to say that if blue collar types are no longer associating themselves with the Democratic Party, it's probably a problem for the Democrats. I think that. You know, I think that these, you know, anecdotal examples are always interesting to hear about. But when you look at the results in elections, for example, or polls or things like that, a different story emerges. When a very pro-abortion attorney general ran for re-election in Kansas last time, he was defeated in counties where the biggest town was 1,000 people. And it was simply because they didn't like the idea. It was not that they were necessarily endorsing abortion or opposing it, but they didn't like the way one candidate approached the way in which he performed the tasks associated with his office. They liked the way the other guy proposed doing it better. And so they voted for the pro-abortion candidate. But it does come down to those kinds of decisions. It does not mean that, that people in little towns in Kansas think that, abortion should be unrestricted. But it does mean that they really want somebody who represents them to perform the job professionally well. And that's the way they saw it. So that's how they voted.
Our guest is Dennis Boyles. We are talking with him about his new book, Superior Nebraska, The Common Sense Values of America's Heartland. And he talks about how people on the East and West Coast in those big blue cities have a lot to learn from the Midwest and the core values of the voters here, especially in the small towns and rural areas. Talks about those core values being industriousness, vigor, neighborliness, optimism, moderation, and self-reliance. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this Tuesday, primary election day, February the 19th. Coming up after 9, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, discussing with his guest recently proposed changes to the Great Lakes Water Compact and how they could force for the renegotiation of the current deal. That's coming up after 9 o'clock this morning. We are talking with Dennis Boyles. He's the author of the new book, Superior Nebraska. In it, he decries the myth that hapless Midwesterners have been duped into voting against their own economic interests and says that the common sense values of America's heartland are a model for the whole country. Joe in La Crosse is next. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you, Jane. Good morning to both of you. Two things. One is, I absolutely agree with your guest's perspective. One thing I would caution, and then one thing I would recommend. The thing I would caution is sometimes what happens is, in a small town, you can develop not only those wonderful aspects of small town life, and having lived for many years in a small town in the Midwest in Wisconsin, I can appreciate them, but you can also develop an ethos that tends to lack diversity and tends to lack an outward-looking perspective about differences. And so I think there's a cure for that. I think there's a cure for two problems here. One is to revitalize the small towns, and the other is to deal with the immigration issue. I think a really good way to deal with it is to set it up so that we open immigration on a broader basis, but that we restrict where people can go, which I don't think is an unreasonable thing to do if somebody wants to come to your country, and say that for 10 years, for example, you can't be within 50 miles of a major metropolitan area.
Yeah, Joe, I don't want to divert our discussion too much into your thoughts on immigration reform because it's really off our focus today. But what about his talk about diversity and small towns and the issues that raises?
Well, I think small towns are grateful to get anybody. One person arriving in a town of 1,000 people can make a huge difference. In fact, I devoted a whole chapter in this book to how the decision by one guy to retire to a little town called Lindsborg, Kansas, resulted in the oddest thing I've ever seen, which was Gorbachev walking down the main street saying hello to people. You really make a big difference when you move to a small town, and so small town people know that, and they're very hopeful when somebody new comes to town. There's a the place on the main street of Concordia, Kansas. And this is right off Highway 81, the old Meridian Highway. It goes from South America all the way up Central America up to the Canadian border, and U.S. 81 is the remnant of that. A family of Mexicans was driving up 81. They were headed for Nebraska, thinking they could open a Mexican restaurant up there someplace. They got to one of the few traffic lights on U.S. 81 and turned left onto the main street of Concordia and realized there was no Mexican restaurant there. So they opened one. And within 2 years, other towns nearby were seeing their success drawing away people from the shopping district so successfully that they were coming to this family and offering them buildings in their towns if they would just please open a Mexican restaurant there. So I think that, you know, in terms of the welcome these people got, I have no idea of their immigration status at all. I don't think anybody really wants to know because the food's awfully good and cheap. They were extremely welcome. And I just don't see that so much. I talk in the book about the little town of Fowler, Kansas. There are five black people in this town, because the town's only about 300 people. But all five of them are adopted children living with conservative white families. I think there's a tradition of openness in the Midwest that is largely overlooked. Those orphan trains that used to take, you know, orphans from the streets of Boston and New York and bring them out to the Midwest were wildly successful. And one of the reasons they were successful was because people are extremely grateful when somebody new comes to town. They're suspicious, they're nervous, they gossip, they do all the things that human beings do. But most of all, they're glad to see a new face.
Thank you, Joe, for the call. Eugene and Viola is next. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning. Good morning, Joy. Hi. I taught in the northeast corner of Nebraska. Many, many years ago, about 30 years ago for a few years. And I was living in the little village of Lynch, and I was teaching across the Niobrara River in Holt County.
Yeah.
And at that time, Nebraska still operated three-man school board and county superintendents, and they didn't get rid of that system until the year 2000.
That's right.
And when I got there, I had picked up the job through a teacher placement service out of Pierce, South Dakota. And I went down and I sat down and I interviewed with three men that had never gone to college. And they were just wonderful. Now, they hired me as an outsider, and they were just wonderful with my wife and I in the time we were down there. Yeah. They were just good people to work with. And one of the surprising things, my wife and I got there early in August that year, and I went to the county superintendent's office, and I said, what textbooks do I use? They said, you can use anything you wish with approval of your three-man school board. And, boy, I tell you, my eyes lit up and just big. And I went through all the textbooks I had, and I went to the three-man board, and I said, this is what you've got, and this is what I think you should do, because the state, you're going to have to start updating these. And they let me do it, and it worked. They were very, very good people. It was an Irish community up in the northeast corner.
Wow.
But it couldn't have been better. And academically, they believe in academics. Mm-hmm. You bet, boy. They want their children to get a good education.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Boyles?
Well, they do. I mean, they. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really interesting. In all across the Midwest, the one area of life that has become increasingly blue, I think, is education. My cousin Dale, I think he's in his 80s now. He used to be a superintendent of a lot of these little towns, and you know, he made a tiny bit of money. He used to drive the school bus himself, and essentially behaved like those three guys who hired your caller. It's no longer that way. Schools are now enormously large complexes, far too large for communities to support them. So they're always consolidating and becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. But in the literature, there is no example of a student going to a bigger school and doing better. The smaller the school, the better the outcome. But the trend is the other way around, because people have been convinced that, you know, a big school is good and the big government that comes with it is good. And it's not. The outcomes are suffering. And you're also finding the emergence in the last 10 years of an administrative class that is extraordinary. I talked to one school superintendent in Kansas. He had 220 students. He was being paid the same salary as the governor of Kansas. He's getting $203,000 a year. the amount of money they spend on superintendents in the state of Kansas, I don't know what it's like in Wisconsin, but I bet it's the same. The amount of money they spend on superintendents and that administrative layer of education is more than they spend on transportation, building maintenance, all the libraries, the plant itself, on school nurses, on food, together. So the enormous expense of this new layer of kind of government that has been applied to these schools is literally breaking the budget of a lot of these small towns and states.
Mm-hmm. Eugene, thanks very much. Diane in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Diane.
Thank you. What were some of the surprising differences you found living in France compared to Kansas and Nebraska?
Actually, I found a lot of similarities. I mean, every place I live in France has been a small farming area. And the concerns of the people are very much the same. The disregard for big government schemes is about the same. The French have as much government as Kansas does. Kansas is, you can take a county with 3,000 people, it'll have a county government, and then the county seat with 1,500 people will have its own government, their own police force, their own fire department. It's crazy. There's so many layers of government in Kansas that it looks French. Yet the one thing they all have in common is that they kind of disregard the government when it gets, you know, in the way. And certainly that's probably more true in France than it is in Kansas and Nebraska.
Yeah. I think you referred to it in your book, those headlines we saw after the Bush-Kerry election, when Bush was elected. It was, it wasn't just dissing Midwestern voters, it was dissing the entire country, but it was, how can so many people be so stupid?
Yeah, there was a British newspaper that asked how could 59 million people be so stupid, and I had to point out that was about the population of Britain. Europe is essentially the most blue of all blue states.
Uh-huh.
Their view of government is very compatible with the view of government in large urban areas of America, and so they don't kind of understand why people would vote that way. And there's also kind of a personality disconnect. When you get somebody like Bush, who's not a very romantic figure, the Europeans kind of like style in their leaders. And I mean, I'm living in a country where the First Lady is Carla Bruni. Man, I mean, mm-hmm. Don't get much more stylish than that. So, I think it's a cultural thing, but I also think it's a way they view government, and I think it's different.
Next we go to Lisa in Marshfield. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. We just moved here about 6 months ago from a larger city in the West, and I've lived in Europe too, and we picked it for all the great things you've talked about. But I taught school there, and I'm wondering what your view is on how living in a big city and you see people who don't take care of themselves, don't take care of their family, and how that influences this view to become more democratic, less self-reliant. But how can you expect people to be self-reliant when, as a teacher, I saw kids, living on their own or that weren't cared for at all?
Right. I'm not sure what your question is.
I'm just wondering how you feel, like, as you're talking about this divide and the Republicans maybe are more self-reliant, how do you feel like the people in big cities who vote more democratically, how does this influences that decision, the fact that they are surrounded by lots of people and lots of people who move there because they can't take care of themselves, they don't want to take care of their families?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's a party issue or not. I think that people in small towns, in terms of misbehavior toward their families and things like that, get away with a lot less simply because everybody knows everybody else's business. in a large town, lots of misbehavior can take place because nobody sees you. But I don't know if that translates to an ideology. I think that the problems that people have with modern life and with the spiritual health of their family and things like that, I think these things really are reasons why this kind of civic misadventure takes place. I don't think Republicans or Democrats own the idea of family morality. I think that it's something that's owned by families. Some do it well, some don't.
Yeah, and people don't move to cities because they don't want to take care of their families.
No, it's, I think that, you know, I think the more, if you don't, if you get 100 people together and somebody's broke and out of luck, I talk about Superior, Nebraska, for example, how, you know, a woman who's quoted by the New York Times as saying that poverty was every place around her, and I called her back. I said, what are you talking about, Sylvia? And she said, they misquoted me. I mean, what I was talking about was that even when there are poor people around us, we all get together and help out. You know, if somebody's down on their luck, we'll put together a yard sale for them and stuff like that. I think that kind of thing goes on a lot more often in small towns. But I think it's because how do you do that in a big town? How do you do that in a big city? First of all, the government's in the way. You know, you can't. You've got, you know, social services and all kinds of stuff to contend with. So it's really hard for one person to have a direct influence on another person's life. And when you get lots and lots of people together, some people are going to be impoverished and some are not going to be able to deal with life as well as others.
Yeah. Thanks to Lisa. Steve is our next caller. He's listening on the web. He's in Houston, Texas. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. This is a great show. Mm-hmm. Hey, boy, you know, I'm glad somebody finally came in defense of rural America, you know, because I have lived and traveled all over the Midwest, including all over Kansas and Nebraska, and I have felt this way for such a long time that, you know, that there is such a sense that I saw over a whole lot of America of small towns, people really, you know, pitching in, living for each other, you know, and I saw farmers who would get ill and they have their neighbors come and harvest their crops, and people really care for each other because they have to, and there is an independence of government, and there is a strong independence, as your guest has alluded to, and there is a common sense that you don't get, you know, at Harvard. There is a strong sense of wisdom that you get about how to live in peace. And I live in the city now, just outside of Houston, and our community, our small town, is being ravaged by drugs. And you see, Houston has become a war zone in many ways. We see sirens going off, police day and night around here. It's very sad. And you know, there is a strong dependence on government here for many things. You know, if you want to talk about politics, the Democrats run most of the big cities in this country, many of them, and you have a lot of people dependent on government, and you also have, you know, great problem with crime.
Steve, I really appreciate your call. We have less than a minute for our guest to give a very brief response. He was listing all those values.
Yeah,
that Dennis Boyles.
I think there's a good point there, but I think that the one thing to pay attention to here in terms of voting Republican, voting Democrat, is that Republicans tend to be able to embrace points of view that are represented by libertarians and by populists much more readily than Democrats do these days. I mean, fighting Bob La Follette was a great populist. His reception by the Republicans wasn't notably warm. I think that's changed. And I think that that in small towns, when you find a way of humanizing government, of bringing these social problems down to a personal level, you find that it's often a Republican candidate that's representing those values.
I have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
My great pleasure.
Dennis Boyles, author of Superior, Nebraska. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.